Good morning. The topic of this speech is optimizing images for OpenStack with KVM QEMU. A couple of notes before we get started. When you're dealing with OpenStack, there is always more than one way to do things. There is just support for tons of different formats. So to scale this down to a half-hour presentation, we're basically just going ahead and we're going to talk about one subset that we find to be the most common and the easiest way to work with this. So there's a list of software that we're using, QEMU. We're going to be talking about OpenStack Grizzly mostly here. I know Havana was just released officially. Libvirt, and for guest OSs, we're going to talk exclusively about Ubuntu, specifically 12.04 LTS, and sort of semi-recent versions of Red Hat-based operating systems. So when you're talking about building VM images in OpenStack, there's two formats that you are often concerned with. And those are the disk and the container formats. Your disk format is essentially it's really just a file representation of the hard drive for your virtual system. QEMU and KVM support a ton of different disk formats. Again, like I said earlier, there's a ton of different options. We're going to scale this down to probably the two most common. And those are the raw format and the qcow2 format. Containers are a little bit of a confusing topic. In fact, you can actually find OpenStack documentation that tells you containers are just ignored largely. But the concept of the container is that it's essentially most commonly a disk file with some sort of metadata about that disk file, which will help you launch a useful and usable instance. And for the purposes of this talk, we're going to be discussing the AMI format, the Amazon Machine Image, which is one of the more common formats you'll come across. So moving on to the disk formats, we'll start out with the raw, because the raw disk format is really, it's the most basic format you'll probably come across. It's literally it's what you would get if you took a hard drive and you DD'd its contents into a file. It's just a direct representation of that in a file. If the file system that you are using to store this happens to be sparse, your raw files can be sparse. Because it is so basic, it's supported by pretty much every platform out there. And because it's so simple, you can treat it just like any other block device, and you can use all your regular Unix tools to manipulate it. You can fdisk, you can mount it, and manipulate it. The qcow2 disk format, and it's part of the QEMU project, it's the QEMU copy-on-write version 2 format, is a little bit different. It supports pre-allocation and on-demand allocation of its blocks. So what that means is your raw is like the pre-allocation, where you're creating a disk file and you allocate the entire disk file. With a qcow2 file, you can create your qcow2 file and set a size on it, but you don't actually have to allocate all of that at the time. You're basically just setting a size and you're saying, and it can grow and take up this much space. Additionally, your qcow2 files have a bunch of features that are built into them, that are inherent to them outside of any other features that OpenStack or Libvirt might give you. One is they have support for read-only backing files. So you can take, say, a raw image, and you can create a qcow2 file, set a size on it, and tell it to use that raw as your backing file. Now, when you create this qcow2, it doesn't really create anything at that point. It's just you have a pointer back to your backing file. And you can read from that qcow2, and it reads the data from the backing file. Nothing actually gets written until you to the qcow2 file until you start doing writes. And that's sort of where the copy-on-write aspect of this comes in. Other features that are supported inside the qcow2 disk format: snapshots, and that's both internal to the qcow file itself or external to other files, as well as compression via zlib, and encryption, I believe AES, and there's one other, I think that I'm just forgetting off the top of my head, sorry about that. So comparing the raw and QCAT2s, we've sort of done that a little bit, but to get it all out there, raw is really simple. It has very little overhead, and because of this, when you're using it, it tends to have the performance advantage. It's usually the your fastest option. QCAT2s, on the other hand, they were designed for virtualization, and they're actively developed with features for cloud computing in mind. And in some cases, that gives you some functionality that's really nice and really helpful. Again, and they also support snapshots internally, not as an added feature of OpenStack or the virtualization layer. Some of the benefits of QCAT2s, one of the biggest benefits that we see is you get much faster instance launching when you're working off of QCAT2s. And that's because of the backing files. When you're launching an instance from raw, you have to copy that entire raw. So you spend a lot of time doing your moving data around. With QCAT2, you just create the data and point it at your backing file, and you're off to the races. Also, when you're launching instances with a QCAT2, you basically assign a size and you go. When you're dealing with RAWs, if you want to change the size, you actually have to perform resizes, and that can take time. Also, your QCAT2 format will let you increase your storage efficiency. When you're dealing with RAWs, if you're launching 100 instances off an image, you have 100 copies of that now sitting around. If you're dealing with QCAT2s with backing files, you know, you have one copy of that image initially, and then your QCAT2 files only contain the deltas. So that lets you provision a little bit more thinly than you may have otherwise. So moving on to the container formats here, the AMI. And AMI is sort of confusing. It's a little bit of an identity crisis because it's a disk format, it's a container format, it's a raw. And it's all of that all at once. Your AMI is, as a container, is really comprised of three different files. So you've got your AMI file, which is a raw file. And the interesting thing about it is it contains no partition information or boot sectors. You can just mount up a raw disk, not put a partition on it, and just lay a file system down on it, and that's essentially what a raw is. The other two files that are part of your AMI are your AKI, or your Amazon kernel image, and your ARI, or your RAM disk image, Amazon RAM disk image. And they are respectively just a kernel and a RAM disk. And when you boot an AMI, you can't just boot the AMI file itself. You have to also provide it with a RAM disk and a kernel, and then the system will use all three files in conjunction to launch. and speaking of launching an instance, I wanted to just go over the process in OpenStack for launching a new instance. At a very basic level, you start out, a user selects an image that they're going to launch their instance based off of, and a flavor. Now, a flavor is essentially just a profile for a virtual machine, how many virtual CPUs, how much memory, how big the root disk should be. There is some other information that is provided when you launch an instance, but for the purposes of this, we'll talk about some of those later. For the purposes of this, we're only concerned with the image and the flavor. So the user goes to launch the instance. The request gets sent off to a compute node. So the first thing that the compute node does when it tries to launch the instance is it checks to see if it already has that image available locally. And it stores, you specify your instance directory in your NovaConf, and the images live in _base under your instance dir. If the file's there, it's great, we move on to the next step. If the file's not there, the compute node talks to the Glance database and pulls down the image. Now, in the process of pulling down that image, regardless of how you uploaded that file into Glance and what format it's in Glance, it gets converted to a RAW. And it converts it to a RAW, and it stores it in that base directory. Now, if the image you're launching is going to be QCAT2 based, which is the default for Nova, a disk file is created. A QCAT2 disk file is created. It's dynamically allocated, so it's just a pointer back to the base file. And the base file it uses is the image that was either there or that it just downloaded and converted to a RAW. At the time this happens, the disk size is also set, because, and I say set because it's a QCAL, so we don't actually have to perform a resize. If your flavor specifies a size, it's set to the size that the flavor specifies. You can have flavors with a size of zero. When you do that, the disk gets set to the size of the flavor. There's a couple of interesting things that happen because of this. One is that if your images are really small and don't have any free space in them and you create flavors with size zero, you're going to boot up systems and they're going to have no available space. The other is that when you're playing with flavors and your image sizes, if you create flavors that specify smaller disks than the actual size of your image, Nova gets mad at you and gets cranky and fails to launch the instance. Now, QCAL2 is the default. You can override that. It requires setting a flag in your config, so use cow images equals false. If you do that, you'll start using raw files for your disk images, and those will be created in exactly the same place, except in this case, a copy is required. It's not just creating the QCAL2 file with a backing file, pointing to the backing file. It actually has to copy all that data, as we mentioned earlier, so that takes a little bit longer. And then after it's copying, it also has to resize it. So this isn't just setting the size, this is actually doing the resize, which can also take time. The same rules apply. If there's no flavor, it gets set to the size of the instance, and if there is a flavor, it gets resized to the size of the flavor. So that's the basics of how we get an instance launched. But the image that that's launched from is kind of important, and there's a bunch of things that you can do to sort of optimize those images for behavior in a cloud environment. There are a bunch of tools that we use on a daily basis. In this space, there are probably hundreds of tools available, and everybody has their own favorites. These are ours. If you like another tool better and it works great for you, that's awesome. From the Qemu project itself, there are two tools we use, Qemu Image and Qemu MBD. Qemu Image, it's really, for lack of a better term, sort of a Swiss Army knife. It can deal with a wide variety of file formats, disk formats. It can do resizes on them. It can do conversions between most of them. And Qemu MBD allows you to mount QCAL2 files. So it'll read the file, it'll read the backing file, it'll parse out the partition structure, and basically allow you to mount it and manipulate the data in your QCAL image. There's another project out there called libguestfs. It's a great project. If you are not familiar with it, I highly suggest checking it out. It provides a couple of great tools. The first one is guest mount. It requires Fuse, and it allows you to mount a wide variety of disk formats. And the other part of the libguestfs suite that we use a lot is for file systems. And that just, it provides you a lot of detail about your disk files. One tool that we use, but not in the way that we use the ones previously mentioned, is CloudInit. CloudInit is brought to us by Canonical, the guys who brought us Ubuntu. And we actually make sure that CloudInit is set up and installed on all of our image files, all of our OS images. CloudInit does a lot. It does a lot more than we actually use it for. It probably does a lot more than most people use it for. The big thing we use it for is that it leverages Nova's API service. And what Nova's API service is essentially the same thing, or compatible with the EC2 metadata service, if you're familiar with that. It allows you to, at launch time, specify a bunch of metadata about the instance that you're about to launch. And then CloudInit will grab that information after the instance comes up. It does so by going to a special address. It's the link local address. and it pulls down all that metadata, it parses it out, and then takes actions on it. And that's really useful for, you know, for getting your instance up and getting it barely minimally configured so that you can move on and do useful things with your new machine. CloudInit also provides modules for dynamically resizing the root file systems. And that's kind of important because before, even though we were talking about resizing the disks and setting the disk size, we're just resizing the disk there. We're not actually resizing the file systems. So it would be like if you had a 10 gig hard drive in your system and you filled it up. So you got a 20 gig hard drive. You DD'd all the information from your 10 to your 20. You booted up off the 20. Well, you still have a 10 gig partition that's full. So this will let you grow it out and use the 20. And it's the same thing. After you resize the disk, you can then grow out your partition to actually be able to utilize the rest of that disk. One interesting thing about AMIs is that since they don't have a partition table, they can just use the rest of the disk. CloudInit installation tends to be pretty easy. If you're using an Ubuntu system, you just apt-get it. If you're working off of a Red Hat-based system, the packages aren't available natively. You can always download them from the EPL repositories. It's just a set of enterprise-grade packages provided for users of Red Hat-based systems. Just point your yum config at it, and you're off to the races. If you're of the right mindset, you can also just download the source and install it yourself or build your own packages. So our CloudInit configuration that we use on our generic images is it's pretty basic. And it's basic for one reason. We're not trying to do a lot with these images. When we build images, we figure they're going to be used. You're going to have a small set of really well curated images that your company is going to use, and you're going to have a lot of people building their machines off of these images. So we try to keep them simple and easy to use, with the expectation that after an instance is launched, that's really just the beginning of the instance's lifecycle. And after it's up, whatever your regular configuration management is going to take over, be it Chef or Puppet or Salt or some poor misguided person with a big checklist of things that they have to go through to build a usable system. So this is just the basics of getting yourself a system, and then configuration management should take over. As part of that, looking at the config, the user cloud. So when we talked about flavors, I skipped over. I said there are a bunch of other things that you can specify when you launch an instance. One of the things that OpenStack lets you do is it lets you specify SSH keys. You can load them into the system, and then when you launch an instance, pick a key to associate with it. CloudInit will take that key and will stuff it in whichever user you specify here. In this case, we use a generic cloud user. Disable root one. We want to disable SSH logins for root. We don't want root to log in remotely. And preserve hostname false. Hostname's another thing you can pass along when you start an instance. It's probably not beneficial to have a bunch of instances start that all have the hostname that your original system that you used to make the image had. So by setting this to false, you allow it to just take that hostname and set the hostname for you. If you're using Ubuntu, there's one caveat with CloudInit, and that's by default, it actually isn't configured to use the EC2 data source. It's easy enough to reconfigure for that, but it's something that you should know. Otherwise, it just won't work. So now that we're done with CloudInit, let's talk a little bit about the authentication model that we use for our images. This could get a little controversial at one point, but hopefully, everything will go smoothly. First thing we do is we disable password-based SSH logins. Pretty firm believers that you should just be using keys. But even aside from that, you're talking about generic images that are meant to be used by a wide range of people. If you have password-based logins enabled, that implies that you have passwords on accounts. And having those passwords on those accounts means that you have to distribute that password to everybody who might use the image. So there's not a lot of real sense in that, because then what's the point of having a password if everybody has it in the first place? Additionally, you have the overhead when you change it of then making sure everybody knows about the change. We also go ahead and we disable remote logins via SSH. Now, I know the Cloud Init config was also doing that, but there's nothing wrong with just being sure. It's always good to sort of double check yourself. Then the next thing we do is we allow everybody in the sudo or wheel groups, depending on what operating system you're dealing with, to get sudo privileges without a password. The reason for this is it's the same reason I discussed before. If you have a password that you have to distribute to everybody, it's really not that useful, not to start at least. So we go ahead and set that up. Continue on. We create the cloud user we mentioned earlier. We add it to the sudo or wheel group, so whoever created the instance can now get into the box and can now administer it as root. We lock that password down, essentially just so that it can't be changed or activated. And then this is the part where people usually start throwing rotten fruit. We allow root logins without a password from the console. And when we first started talking about doing this, it felt really, really dirty. How could you have root without a password? But we thought about the implications of, well, we want people to log in. We have all the hassle of where we're going to give the password to everybody anyway. And on top of that, if you have access in OpenStack currently to launch an instance, you also have access to the virtual console anyway. If you have access to the console, you pretty much de facto have root anyway if you know what you're doing at all. So for those reasons, we set up our root passwords, or we don't set a root password from the console logins. So that covers our basic authentication for letting people into the instances once they're launched. The next thing we need to configure is a couple of things about networking. In the OpenStack world, MAC addresses are assigned to instances when they're created, and they're randomly generated, essentially. So we want to make sure that we're eliminating anything on the systems that are going to bind that MAC address to an interface, or when you launch a new instance, it's going to see a new MAC address and try to spawn another interface, because for the most part, you're dealing with systems with one interface. So we go in and we nuke out the persistent net rules and the write net rules from UDEV to make sure that they don't do anything weird. I know you're sitting there saying, yeah, but the next time you do an update, they're going to come back. And yes, that's true, but at that point, we figure that configuration management has taken over and is going to be managing all of that for us. If you're using a Red Hat variant, you're going to want to go into the ifcfg file for your interface and make sure that you don't have any HW adder lines specified for those interfaces. So the next part of our networking config is we want to set things up for DHCP. Now, by default, both Red Hat variants and Ubuntu, for some reason, they try once to DHCP and then they stop. In a cloud environment, that's really sort of not beneficial. Because what'll happen is that means if your VM happens to be trying to DHCP while your network guys are doing the maintenance, say it's trying to renew its lease while your network team is doing the maintenance, that one try fails, well, eventually that lease is going to expire and your machine's going to drop off the network and it's going to require an administrator to come in and deal with. Alternately, sometimes you just have network problems. It's not even maintenance. I've personally never worked someplace where the network was 100% reliable all the time. So we plan for that. We go ahead and we make sure that the DHCP clients are configured for persistence. With Red Hat, that's really easy. You're back in your if config interface file, and you set persistent DH client equal to yes. That's really easy. Ubuntu, it gets a little bit stranger. Ubuntu, when you're bringing up your network interfaces, it uses ifup for everything. Ifup, by default, when you look at it, one of the first things it does, it says, all right, well, you're using DHCP. If DH client 3 is there, we'll go ahead and use that, and by the way, use this this set of flags. One of those flags happens to be -1, which tells it try once. We tried playing around with the configurations for that, but we couldn't find a way that would consistently between different versions of Ubuntu. I know I said we were going to deal only with LTS here, but we didn't find a really good consistent set of config options between those clients. So we just opted to just remove DH Client 3. DH Client 3 is just a symlink anyway to DH Client, and that's the next step of what IFUP tries to do. It says if DH Client 3 is there, do this. Otherwise, use DH Client with a sane set of options that allows you to just persistently try to get your address. And so the last thing we want to make sure is configured on all the hosts is hotplug support. The main reason for this is because of the Cinder service, Cinder volumes. Cinder allows you to dynamically attach and detach volumes from your running systems if you need additional storage. And it's really great functionality, but if you're not set up for hotplug support, what'll end up happening is you'll try to attach the volume, and it might attach inside the system, but you'll have to reboot to recognize it, and that's not really user-friendly. So a lot of kernels out there already have support for this pre-compiled in. If they don't, there's two modules you have to make sure get loaded. It's the ACPI-PHP and PCI hotplug modules. So just make sure your systems are set up with either kernels that have it precompiled, or make sure those modules load on boot. So that's the really the last thing that we do when we're prepping these images. So putting it all together, just to quickly go over what we talked about. We use raw-backed, dynamically allocated QCOW2s for our instance disks. The reasons we do that is you get much faster instance launching, which users tend to like, as well as increased storage efficiency. And that's all from the same thing. It's because the QCOW2 files basically don't, you know, they're created and they're just pointers back to that backend file. Also, you have snapshotting functionality that's available should you want to use it. Once we start building images, there are a bunch of tools we use. We talked about some of the Kemu tools. Also, we talked about CloudInit and how to get that configured to basically take your instance, pull down a little bit of metadata, and basically configure your basic authentication scheme on your system. Also, we talked about properly preparing your operating system, and you know, from that point of view, it's the authentication, it's the making sure the network is set up in a cloud-friendly way for both the MAC addresses and for the for being able to persistently DHCP, and finally, I'm going to cheat, making sure that the hotplug support is compiled in. So. That's all I have today. If you have any more information, my contact information, this is kind of stupid, but I know these decks get put up on the web, so I want to make sure that I don't get a whole bunch of inadvertent marketing spam. It's my name, Brian, at my company, metacloud.com. So I guess at this point, if anybody has any questions. Thank you.
University of Maryland. I have a question about your service.
Sure.
So, if you're providing this as a service and you have customer data in your infrastructure, is there any sort of policy governing body that you fall under or look to make sure that you're auditing properly?
Okay, so I guess I don't want to turn this into a really salesy thing, because I know most of you guys aren't here for a sales thing, but it's a sort of a specific question about our service. Our service isn't actually something that we build and operate clouds on your hardware and your data centers. So it's not our hardware, it's not our data centers, it's all inside your firewalls.
Okay.
So from that point of view, we fall under whatever guidelines you're subject to.
Okay.
But it's just your data, so we're not worried about data separation between clients, because it's a, you know, each client has their own own little silo in their own data centers.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Anybody else? All right. Well, then, thank you everybody for coming and being a great audience.